A disability rights group is suing the state over how it treats mentally ill inmates. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry looks at how Montana hospitals are trying to reduce infections. Reporter Edward O'Brien finds out more about the new medical helicopter serving Missoula. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with two crime victim advocates about the many services available to the thousands of Montanans who are victims of crime. A civil rights organization is suing the state over the treatment of mentally ill inmates at the state prison and state hospital. Disability Rights Montana says the Departments of Correction and Health and Human Services are subjecting inmates with mental illness to cruel and unusual punishment. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the organization is hoping to resolve the lawsuit without going to court.
The things that we're looking for is changing in conditions in terms of the treatment of prisoners with mental illness.
Disability Rights Montana Executive Director Bernadette Franks-Ongoy. Her organization is filing this suit against the state after more than a year investigating the Montana State Prison and Montana State Hospital. The 54-page suit describes mentally ill inmates as being warehoused in solitary confinement, that they do not receive the care they need. And Franks-Ongoy says overcrowding at the state hospital in Warm Springs has led to transferring inmates over to the prison in order to free up hospital beds. She says that's never appropriate, that the prison does not provide the same level of care.
We believe it's a violation, a rights violation, for someone to be transferred out of the hospital setting to the prison setting without due process taking place.
Franks-Ongoy does believe it's possible to find solutions to these complaints without going to court. She says she's been encouraged by the Department of Corrections' reaction to the suit.
They're definitely willing to roll up their sleeves, and I feel very hopeful that they understand the issues and they're going to try to see how to resolve those.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Montana is one of the entities representing Disability Rights Montana. Staff attorney Anna Conley says other states have already left a model for fixing some of these concerns.
There are many concrete steps that other states have taken to prohibit solitary confinement for prisoners with mental illness, that other states have taken to ensure that there's adequate mental health treatment for prisoners with mental illness.
Conley would not elaborate on any of these potential solutions, not wanting to interfere with settlement negotiations with the state. She says while they have been in steady contact with the Department of Corrections on this suit, they have not heard anything from the Department of Public Health and Human Services. Both DPHHS and Corrections declined an interview for this story, saying they will have 60 days to officially respond to the suit after receiving it. They also say they will not be providing further comment on pending litigation. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, Montana officials say author John Krakauer has no right to ask a judge to release documents in the rape case against University of Montana quarterback Jordan Johnson because the writer is not a resident. State attorneys included Krakauer's lack of residency among their defenses in denying his public records request. Krakauer is writing a book that deals in part with how education officials handled a sexual assault complaint against Johnson. Associate Commissioner of Higher Education Kevin McCray cited a 2013 U.S. Supreme Court decision today that upheld a Virginia law that does not grant rights to out-of-state requesters. Attorney Jessica Brubaker says it is unclear whether the state will pursue that defense, but it wants to keep the option open. Krakauer attorney Mike Malloy says the Montana Constitution does not limit those rights.
Ravalli County officials say a search warrant is being served on a Florence clinic as part of a two-year investigation into the doctor's prescription writing practices. Sheriff Chris Hoffman and County Attorney Bill Fulbright say deputies, along with the Missoula High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Task Force, the State Division of Criminal Investigation, and U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, served a search warrant this morning at Big Creek Family Medicine and Urgent Care in Florence. District Judge Jim Haynes is issued the warrant after a nearly two-year investigation into the prescription writing practices of a physician at the clinic. No criminal charges have been filed.
Montana as a state comes in below the national average for people picking up an infection at the hospital. Nationally, the Centers for Disease Control says hospitals are making improvements, however, the statistics are still scary. The CDC says each day, 1 in 25 U.S. patients contracts an infection in the hospital, adding up to more than 700,000 each year. Katrin Fry reports the approach to preventing infections is evolving. One element is the role patients play in preventing infection.
Say you're in the restroom at a public place, like the mall. You're at the sink washing your hands, and you see the sign, complete with step-by-step pictures on how to wash your hands. Ever actually read that sign? It tells you to wash your hands for 20 seconds. For a little perspective, I've been talking for 20 seconds. Registered nurse Melody Finch says proper hand hygiene is the first step in prevention, and this relates to alcohol-based hand sanitizers as well as soap and water.
One of the things I've run into is when they're doing the alcohol sanitizer, that they're putting the dollop on their hand, and they're just rubbing their palms together for just a few seconds, and then they kind of wave their hands in the air for it to dry. That's not the correct way to do it. You actually put it in your hands, and you rub it all over your hands until it's actually dry, and that should take 15 to 20 seconds. Otherwise, you're really not doing it effectively.
Finch and registered nurse Laura Bermel work in the Infection Prevention Department at Kalispell Regional Medical Center. Bermel says she's worked as a nurse for about 30 years, and over the last several years, she's seen a growing focus on what patients can do to help themselves avoid acquiring an infection.
We spend a lot of time talking to people about making sure you're clean and prepared for surgery, making sure you don't smoke because that inhibits the immune system and makes you less able to fight infection.
Bermel says this also means encouraging patients to ask their doctor or nurse if they've washed their hands. The Centers for Disease Control recently released a report on rates of healthcare-associated infections in the U.S. The report says every day, more than 200 Americans with healthcare-associated infections will die. Big Fork resident Dr. Rodney Ogren created a product called Sprix that he believes could go a long way toward preventing infection and death. It's a portable hand sanitizer that clips to a person's clothes. Ogren's background is in dentistry. He says about 10 years ago, he was talking with a physician bemoaning the state of hand hygiene in the healthcare industry.
He said, I think if they had something attached to their body, they wouldn't have to take the time to walk to a dispenser. And in fact, he pointed out because their time, they're real tight on their time taking care of patients, that they'll skip hand sanitation in favor of getting the job done.
Ogren says this makes it available to a healthcare worker at every point of care.
And that's everything in the immediate patient's and immediate environment. And so that means they sanitize their hands before they touch the patient, after they touch the patient, whenever they touch anything in the patient's immediate environment.
Some hospital systems have adopted his product in the past year, including the University of California in San Francisco, Irvine, and Barnabas Health out on the East Coast. All the prevention efforts aim to keep people from transmitting infections from one patient to another by keeping hands, tools, and surfaces clean. Bermel says a change on the caregiver side of prevention over the past several years is how antibiotics are used.
You don't go to the doctor, I think, and get an antibiotic prescribed for colds and things like that as readily. They really do wait to see if it warrants it. If you are not recovering after a week, they might consider antibiotics, for example. So they are trying to be very much more careful. They've recognized that antibiotics aren't a silver bullet. They're not going to kill everything every time.
Bermel says now specific antibiotics are administered at particular times during a surgery and generally for a set amount of time afterwards. The goal is reducing or avoiding antibiotic-resistant superbugs and then keeping hands, surfaces, and people clean so they don't pick up superbugs while at the hospital. The CDC measures three specific areas to determine how hospitals are doing with healthcare-associated infections. A central line is a tube that a doctor usually places in a large vein on a patient's neck or chest. These are at high risk for bloodstream infections. In the CDC's recent report, Montana didn't have enough data to report how the state's hospitals are doing. The same is true for surgical site infections for colon surgery and abdominal hysterectomy surgery. However, in catheter-associated infections, no Montana hospitals had infection rates higher than the national average of 1%. Bermel says Kalispell also comes in under the national average, but their target is zero.
People who develop a urinary tract infection because they've had a Foley catheter in will end up staying longer in the hospital. They will end up with additional treatment that they wouldn't have had to have. People who develop surgery site infections might sometimes come back for an additional procedure then, and it causes life changes for those people.
Bermel says they look at each infection that does occur to see if a step was missed and how it can be prevented in the future. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
It was a case of out with the old and in with the new today in Missoula as a brand new medical helicopter and its Montana team visited the two local hospitals they'll serve. Northwest MedStar has replaced Life Flight, the air ambulance service that was operated by St. Patrick Hospital and also served Missoula's community hospital. Life Flight began operating in Missoula in the early 80s. The two hospitals merged their separate air ambulance services in 2012 and announced late last year that they entered into an agreement with the Spokane-based Northwest MedStar. The decision was estimated to save hundreds of thousands of dollars. Edward O'Brien attended today's first meet-and-greet ceremony at St. Pat's and brings us this story.
About 30 people stopped by Providence St. Patrick Hospital's Broadway campus building today to get a peek at the new chopper. And they weren't disappointed on this cool, bright blue early spring day. Right on time, the sleek new EC-135 swiftly and nimbly swooped in, made a pass around the building, and came in for its final approach on the front lawn with its nose pointed to the north. It certainly must have surprised unsuspecting drivers on Broadway as that helicopter went right over their car roofs and in its powerful rotor wash kicked up road grit, dirt, and litter as it made its loud, admittedly exciting, and remarkably gentle landing. MedStar's Missoula-based chief, Tony Rayner, is brand new to town, just moved here from South Carolina. He points out some of the key differences between the new helicopter and the familiar yellow and green Life Flight chopper it replaces.
It's a rear-loading aircraft. It does have a dedicated stretcher, and that makes quite a large difference, say, if you're on a scene call. And even if you go to inter-facility or in-between hospital transfers, you no longer rely on the ER staff or security to bring you a stretcher. You have your own dedicated stretcher. You can load from the rear instead of relying on the sled and the side enter, so it's actually quite a bit easier for the crews. The other difference is that, given this rear-loading configuration, the prior aircraft, the patient basically was right beside the pilot. So this one, there's no communication, as in the patient cannot reach the pilot. So there's that safety factor.
Rayner adds the new platform is a powerhouse that sports a different style.
It's a dual-engine aircraft. And the other large thing is you'll notice, if you can see it on the old aircraft, you'll see that exposed tail rotor.
Yes.
This one has an enclosed tail rotor, as there's no spinning blade that you could accidentally walk into. If you wanted to, of course, from the side, but overall it is still a safer aircraft. It has a greater rotor height, and then like I said, with the enclosed tail rotor.
Hugh Peterson is a registered nurse who works in the helicopter. He's done this for almost 10 years and admits that while the job can be thrilling, it can also be really scary.
At times it can be, but you know, we focus on safety a lot. That's a primary concern. But when we have our patient back, we focus on them, and you know, all the scary things kind of go away as we focus on our patients and treating them. So,
what's it like? You're landing, maybe I'm just, you know, making this up, on a highway somewhere, terrible car accident. You have a patient who's screaming in pain, and it's such a cramped workspace, it seems like to me. What's your workflow? I mean, how does everybody organize together?
Well, communication is key, right? From the beginning when you're landing for safety purposes and communicating with your partner on the priorities of patient care. Of course, making the patient comfortable and treating their life-threatening injuries, that's important. But yes, we try to get everything done before we put them in the helicopter if we can. But if it's an urgent situation, we need to get them here where the physicians can treat them. Sometimes we'll have to do things inside the helicopter, and it gets very cramped. Yeah, I think it's worse than a Volkswagen if you've crammed five or six people in a Volkswagen.
It's like a clown car.
It can almost be that way, yeah.
The work comes with inherent risks, risks Peterson says are always on the minds of the flight team.
Morbid question. Seattle, a couple of weeks ago, terrible urban helicopter accident. That has to go through not only your mind, but your family's and friends' loved ones' minds as well.
Yeah, and those are the kinds of things we like to avoid, right? But they're rampant in the industry. You know, we do what we can to prevent that stuff. We're very thorough in our safety approach. We have a safety brief every day. You know, every once in a while you'll get that mechanical failure. It's a sad thing. You know, one of our pilots knew that pilot there, was acquainted with him, and so it brings it home. It really brings it home. So we do everything we can to provide for the safety of the crew and the patients that we transport.
Northwest MedStar begins its service from its base at Missoula International Airport tomorrow morning with the helicopter, a fixed-wing plane, and its ambulance service. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Edward O'Brien.
Last year, 37,000 Montanans were the victims of crime, according to the State Board of Crime Control. 30 years ago, there were very few services for crime victims, but today, every state has those services, everything from counseling to advocacy, and every state has a Crime Victims Compensation Fund. Next week is National Crime Victims' Rights Week, which has been held every year since 1981 to increase public awareness of victims' rights and services. In this feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with University of Montana Campus Assault Prevention Coordinator Kimberly Campbell and Aaron Counts of the Missoula City County Crime Victim Advocate Office about what they do to help victims cope with the trauma and aftermath of being victimized.
We really make every effort we can to get in touch with victims of crime, in particular, you know, sexual assault, domestic violence, and stalking cases. Our office also follows up on aggravated assault, on homicides, and we try to get in touch with them and serve as a liaison between them and the criminal justice system.
Why is that important? Why do you need a liaison? Because it seems like if you call up the police and say, look, I just got robbed and...
The process can be completely overwhelming for people. You know, first of all, they've just had a major trauma. They've been assaulted. They've been hurt. They've been injured. You know, they probably have dealt with law enforcement and they don't know what to do next. And then they're also now getting in touch with the prosecutors and the court system, and it can just be completely overwhelming. So our office, our advocates try to make sure that their voice is heard in that system with whatever they want. We fully support them if, you know, if they decide they want to pursue charges or if they don't. We believe in an empowerment model. So we support the victim no matter what they want and try to make sure that they're aware of what their options are, that there are people out there that can help them, and then make sure that their voice is heard throughout the process, whether it's through the courts or through law enforcement or through the prosecutor's office.
And Kimberly, you deal primarily with sexual assault victims, and those are victims who often don't want to go through the process because they have heard it is so traumatic for them to do that.
Right. We try to encourage folks that reporting, sort of the word reporting, oftentimes leads people to think that that means reporting to law enforcement. And while that is important, if that's something that someone chooses to do, reporting can really mean on campus, specifically going to Curry Hill Center and the Student Advocacy Resource Center and reporting to an advocate there and talking out options in terms of what one step further reporting might be, and or if there are any counseling, crisis counseling, psychotherapy, any other options. There are groups for survivors. So reporting can mean more than just report making a police report or an Office of Public Safety report.
And it may not mean making a police report.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because victims, one thing that they don't want to happen is to be re-victimized by the system. And that's really why you all exist, isn't it, is to keep that from happening.
Missoula has actually, I think, a pretty outstanding network of providers who are there to help victims of crime. Unless you are the victim of the crime, you may not know about it. And so, you know, the YWCA has a 24-hour crisis line. SARC has a crisis line.
SARC is the Sexual Assault Recovery Center.
Yeah, although their name has changed.
Yeah, it's now Student Advocacy Resource Center.
Okay. They both have crisis lines. You know, our office, the Crime Victim Advocate Program, follows up. You know, we help with orders of protection as well as the criminal side of things within the court system. And all of us work together, and we work with law enforcement, and we work with the prosecutors or not, you know, whatever the case may be, to make sure that people can get the services that they need.
the national statistic from the Board of Crime Control says that more than half of violent crimes go unreported. But those people could still come to you, could they not?
Oh, definitely. The majority – so I'm actually the – I work more on the order of protection side of things, at what we call the civil side of things, so doing crisis counseling and helping with orders of protection, which are most commonly known as restraining orders. The majority of people that come in to get one of those have never reported. It's basically they just come in. They need – they're afraid. There has to be the fear of bodily harm, and they're afraid. They've never called law enforcement for one reason or another, and they just – but they need a judge's order to keep this person away from them to be safe.
Kimberly, when you're doing this kind of work, what's your satisfaction? How do you measure that?
I think getting students involved, my new work, I just started at the university three-quarter time in January, and I think having students involved in reaching out, speaking out, standing up. We're working on bystander intervention training is our big thing right now. So if you are in a situation where there's potential risky behavior that, and you can stay safe in intervening, then that's what we're working on right now. And so just having students working on this issue and moving forward with prevention efforts is makes me the happiest in my job.
And Erin, I assume that you help victims reclaim some power that mm-hmm. they feel they've lost, right?
Well,
it must be the most powerless
to.
Feeling.
Yeah, we hope to. I mean, and for many people, that could take a variety of forms depending on the person. You know, it could be being able to make decisions for the first time in their life. It could be being able to live their life without fear, you know, not having to keep the house spotless for an abuser or, you know, keep the kids quiet all the time. It, you know, power comes in many forms, and we really hope that it's up to each individual to find that for themselves. But our hope is that we can be there to help support them and find the avenue that helps them find that the best, because really it has to come from within.
There were 37,000 Montanans victims of crime. These, I assume, are reported crimes, mm-hmm. not to mention all the ones that weren't reported. And that's a lot of mm-hmm. Montanans who could avail themselves of these services if they feel mm-hmm. that they would like to do that.
Yeah, we hope they do. I mean, our office does try to follow up on every reported crime, a violent crime that happens in Missoula. But, yeah, we know that there are probably five times at least as many that go unreported, and we want to make sure that they know that there are options. You know, the news tends to focus on the negative and what we don't have, but really Missoula has a pretty good support system for people if they choose to reach out and look for services.
And certainly in sexual assault, the vast majority go unreported.
Yes, and just to quote some statistics that for university-aged demographic 18 to 25, one in four women will be sexually assaulted, and one in 16 men will experience some unwanted sexual experience within their college career of that age group. So that's a pretty resounding statistic that I think through prevention, I'm hoping we can lower those numbers over a shorter period of time than longer.
And for those who are unfortunately victims, there is help available, and that's mm-hmm.
yes.
what you all are involved in. And I have been speaking with Erin Kautz, who's with the Missoula City County Crime Victim Advocate Office, and with Kimberly Campbell, who's the University of Montana Assault Prevention Coordinator. And next week is National Crime Victims Rights Week, and a good week to remind people that these services are available. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain and snow and lows in the 20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. For central Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies, patchy freezing fog, and isolated snow and rain, and lows are 20 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and rain and highs 35 to 45 degrees. For southwest Montana, there is a winter weather advisory in effect from 6 this evening to noon tomorrow for southern portions of Beaverhead, Madison, and Gallatin counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with snow and scattered rain with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies and snow and rain and highs 40 to 50 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Haypatrick.
Recently, I was asked to speak about collaboration in the nonprofit world, what it is, why it's important, what makes it work, and what makes it fail. That got me thinking. As a start, I looked up collaboration in the dictionary. Its two definitions amused me. Collaboration is first defined as the act of working together with one or more people in order to achieve something, and second, as the betrayal of others by working with an enemy, especially an occupying force. Obviously, I want to focus more on the first definition, but isn't it true that so often when we dip our toes gingerly into the collaboration pool, often pushed to the edge of the water by our funders, we do so from a position of reluctance, doubt, or even fear? We clutch our resources to our chests and find ourselves questioning the motives of others. So often, well-intentioned efforts to collaborate go south into feelings of betrayal and even enmity. This, of course, drowns any chance of success. So before we talk about how to avoid the phenomenon of circling the wagons and firing inward, let's talk about what collaboration isn't. It's not just sharing information or going to the same meetings or endorsing the same legislation or moving in the same circles. It's not a weekend retreat where we navigate a ropes course or fall backwards into each other's arms to learn trust. True collaboration is deliberate, thoughtful, outcome-focused, and has measurable results. It's not just working hard, it's working effectively together to achieve a larger goal. Collaboration works when people and organizations are united around a common vision and inspired to achieve it. As ancient a source as the Book of Proverbs says, without vision, the people fail. The same is true for collaborations. You need a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal, as your North Star. Collaborations work when partners are committed to measuring progress against agreed-upon metrics. How will we know we're succeeding? What quantifiable results, hard facts and figures, can we show our stakeholders so they know we're moving the needle in the right direction? Successful collaborations include partners who keep their eye on the ball, who stay focused not only on the group's larger vision and goals, but on preserving and strengthening the core. The group needs to be strong enough to bring on new partners who are on the same page, and strong enough to jettison those who threaten to derail the effort, including by advancing their own agenda at the expense of the greater good. Effective collaborative partners are also willing to take the risk of forging alliances with untraditional and unfamiliar partners, taking the time to learn each other's strange new language. None of this is easy. Baseball great Casey Stengel was right in noting that getting the players is easy. Getting them to play together, that's the hard part. It takes time and dedicated effort. Every effective collaboration also needs a robust, carefully crafted communications plan that educates stakeholders about progress, because you can have the most flawless vision and execute it perfectly at the appropriate pace, but if you're not communicating to the folks you need to support your work and come along with you, you'll fail. And let's talk about failure. Collaborations fail when ego takes precedence over achieving common goals, because effective collaborations require you to check your organization's ego and sometimes your own personal ego at the door. Because collaborations also fail when partners are more concerned about getting credit than getting things done. As Ralph Waldo Emerson said, there is no limit to what can be accomplished if it doesn't matter who gets the credit. There's a role for everyone to play in advancing visionary goals. Worry less about your own piece of the pie and focus more on baking a bigger pie. Collaboration also fails when partners worry too much about getting along rather than getting ahead, when they're more concerned about harmony among the group and not offending anyone by disagreeing or asking hard questions than they are about their larger goals. Just as you have to break eggs to get an omelet, collaborative partners have to question and criticize. And as long as you do it respectfully, keeping your eye on the ultimate goal, there's nothing wrong with it. Politeness is the poison of collaboration, said Polaroid Corporation founder Edwin Land. But keep it civil. Gang up on the problem, not each other. There are so many examples of successful collaborations in Montana. Every day in Missoula, for example, nonprofits, public employees, faith organizations, business people, donors, and local volunteers work together in different collaborations to tackle homelessness, hunger, sexual assault, childhood obesity, and so much more. Everyone has a unique position to play, but everyone's on the same team. There's much more progress to be made, of course, but these folks know that collaborating effectively is the only way to get anything meaningful accomplished. It's the difference between doing good and getting good done. And increasingly, it's what donors, from the federal government to foundations to local businesses, expect. There's another benefit to good collaborations. Along the way, as you work together to advance the common good, you forge deep connections with people and organizations you might not otherwise have met. Done well, collaboration advances larger, even visionary goals, and creates a ripple effect that can break down barriers and build up partnerships that can change you, your organization, and your community for the better. And that's no April Fool's joke. I'm Susan Hay Patrick, CEO of United Way of Missoula County. Thanks for listening.
Susan Hay Patrick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.